I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
Welcome back to the show. On today's episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Stacy Daughters. Dr. Daughters is a professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she's going to be talking to us about reward processing in substance use disorders and the intersection between neuroscience and psychosocial treatments for substance use disorders.
Stacy, welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're obviously big fans of your work, so we're really excited to talk about your work and some of the things that you've been doing in the substance use disorder space for a while now. But we start off all of our episodes talking a little bit about people's training history to help our audience get to know you a little bit about what kind of expertise you might have. So you could tell us a little bit about your training history.
Sure. Yeah. I started my research journey as an undergrad at the University of Maryland. I didn't do any clinically related research. I actually didn't even know what research was, but my sophomore year, my statistics professor wrote a note on my exam because I'd done really well, said, come see me, and then said, do you want to be my research assistant? And I didn't know what that was, but felt good that someone wanted me to do something for them. And it was basically a tinnitus lab in the basement of the psychology building. And that was the first time I ever collected data. And I was sitting in a little chamber and I was like, oh, this isn't so, you know, this is fine. I enjoyed it. And she then suggested that I do an honors thesis, but wasn't really interested in that. And she said, you know, what are you interested in? I'm like, I don't know, kids maybe. And so she hooked me up with Ellen Skolnick, who was in the developmental program. And I did an honors thesis on sort of ways of knowing between men and women in humanities versus engineering. And that experience really got me excited about research. I learned how to do a factor analysis, collect data from students, and that was really fun. And so at that point, I was a psychology major. I'd been interested in psychology since high school, and I kind of thought that I would just be like a clinician. That's all I really knew what a psychologist was. But then realized that you could do some research. And she said, well, if you want to go to graduate school, you need to actually get some research experience. So I got a job at American Institute of Research in Georgetown. This is the first thing, you know, if I ever give advice is ask questions before you go and do things. I didn't ask any questions. I just said, oh, okay, I'll go find a research institute and get a job. And they didn't really do any psychological research. They did education research. And at that point, I did apply to graduate schools. I didn't get in anywhere, but I got an interview at a couple places. And when they didn't accept me, I said, well, what can I do? And, you know, they said, well, do more research and maybe present a poster somewhere. And, you know, I got off the call and I'm like, what in the world is a poster? I have no idea. So I clearly didn't have much background in research at all. And I share this just to say that I kind of meandered my way into graduate school and didn't have it all figured out right away. And I think a lot of undergrads feel like they need to have that up front. So anyway, I listened to her, but also she told me that Sam Turner and Debbie Beidle had arrived at the University of Maryland since I'd left. And so she's like, call them, you know? And so I did, but at the same time I'd gotten a job at NIH as an IRTA there. So I started full-time at NIH, volunteered with Sam and Debbie at University of Maryland. They ended up accepting me at the University of Maryland the next year. And so that's where I started my graduate training. And so I spent a year with them doing anxiety disorder research. When my second year started, Carl Lejeway arrived at the University of Maryland. And I'd been finding that the anxiety lab wasn't a great fit for me. And so when he arrived, I was like, oh, he's doing addiction. That sounds kind of cool. Maybe I'll go work with him. And I did. And so that's where my addiction training started, is the work that I did with him. And it started with distress tolerance, but distress tolerance in gambling. So I did my master's thesis looking at the relationship between distress tolerance and gambling disorder severity. and then turned to look at this, that in substance use disorder. So began doing work in Washington, D.C. at a community-based residential facility. And what really looking at, you know, mechanistically wanting to identify what predicts treatment response. No one's getting better. Why not? And so my dissertation was looking at the relationship between distress tolerance and treatment dropout from the facility. After that, went to Brown for my clinical internship. Got to work with Chris Kaler, who's fantastic. And he had also been collaborating with us on the work that I was doing at Maryland. So it's a natural fit. And after my year of internship at Brown, kind of had a tough decision deciding whether I wanted to stay at Brown for postdoc, or Carl had offered me a position back in his center as research faculty, because I'd gotten an R36. And so I ended up deciding to go back to Maryland for a number of personal and professional reasons, and took that research faculty job and spent a couple years there in his center, then decided to take a tenure track job staying at Maryland in their School of Public Health. All continuing at this time to continue to build my findings related to substance use treatment response, and specifically distress tolerance. But then as I spent more time in the treatment facility, I became more interested in now we can identify why people aren't getting better, but people are still not getting better. What can we do about it? And so got more into treatment development, and focusing on reward and engagement and, enjoying substance-free reward, and how do we increase that? And that's where the work with behavioral activation started, modifying behavioral activation for depression into one for substance use, and ran a few studies out of the treatment center in DC there. And then at the same time that was happening, I would say maybe 3 or 4 years later into that, after I've been there a few years, as faculty, really kind of wanting to know more about, in particular, the construct of distress tolerance, of what's going on there. It's made up of a whole bunch of different things. You've got, executive functioning, you've got, stress response, what's really happening there. And so that's where then I wanted to think, I was thinking about neuroscience. And so I contacted Elliot Stein at NIDA and, pitched to him that I wanted to do this, look at the neural correlates of distress tolerance. So I worked with him and Tom Ross and his group. We designed distress tolerance fMRI task, looked at the neural correlates, and I ended up getting some training in that. So that's really where my neuroscience focus started. And then a few years after that, I was offered a job at UNC and came to UNC. And I was excited about that because I really missed being in a psychology department, particularly clinical. So I came here about 10 years ago.
Yeah, doing neuroscience in a public health department, I guess that's not the perfect fit. And now you're in the psychology and neuroscience department. But I mean, it's a remarkable trajectory. And I, shout out to your undergraduate, I guess teacher who, or yeah, your first mentor really, who, who got you connected. Sometimes I feel like the people in our field can be almost possessive of students. And it sounds like this person really, listened to what you had to say and got you in touch with people that you would be a good fit for mentorship. And, I thought that was something that really stood out, as you were speaking. But in general, you've worked with some really amazing people, and you've had a really nice trajectory, and obviously are in one of the preeminent departments in our field.
I think you make a good point, that if that faculty member had not reached out and then told me what to do next, it would have never happened. Because most students don't have the exposure, and no one's really telling them what they need to do, and they don't even know what questions to ask to find out. Yeah, so it's nice she just went out of her way to say, hey, I think you can do this. This is how you do it.
Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah. I think that's an underappreciated component of the kind of links in the chain in a person's training. Mm-hmm. It's just like people who really care just being like, hey, have you thought about, like, I mean, numerous people I know over the years, like some mystery person who maybe not even a primary mentor was like, hey, right, like exam, right, like on the top of your exam, like see me. I'm like, oh no, I'm failing out of school. Actually, I love you so much, I want you to come work with me, right? Like things
That
like
was
that
basically
happen, right?
it.
Like there's like all these, and I think people also underappreciate a little bit just like chance, right? Like you took that class with that person that semester, right? Like also like Carl LeJoy showing up, right? Like totally altered the entire trajectory of your career as a function of Carl showing up, right? And you know, things like that. And I think everybody thinks, especially from the outside looking in, like that people had this plan from the beginning, like, oh, here's how I'm gonna make a change in the world or in the field. And really, like a lot of it is just like, huh, you know, oh, who's this Carl dude? I wonder what he's about. That's
That seems
interesting.
pretty fun. I'll go do
Yeah. Oh, what's this
that.
balloon analog wrist task, right? Or like, right, what's the, everybody pronounces it different. Is it the PaySat or the PSAT, right? Like, which is the a distract.
PaySat.
Yeah,
We say
the
PaySat.
yeah, that makes sense. Which is a behavioral distress tolerance task, right? You know, and like all these different types of things that are just like, wow, that looks cool, I'd love to get interested in. And then poof, right now you're a substance use treatment developer, right? And you know, I really think that that's okay. Anybody who's listening, like that is not just okay. That's not a bug in the system. That's a feature. Like going to conferences and meeting people or meeting people, new people in your department and getting interested in new things is encouraged, right? So
And following the path as it develops versus,
totally.
having it set out ahead of time. Because, I mean, just in research, if you think about what research is, right? You run a study, there's a finding, and based on that finding, then you pivot, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, and the same thing, for the career trajectory, depending on who you're around and what you're exposed to and what's interesting to you. And that
Yeah.
constantly changes.
Yeah.
Love that idea of like basically flexibility or I guess cognitive flexibility. But
It is flexible in a lot of ways. Yeah.
But yeah, in some ways I had, I think, a similar trajectory of where I knew I, well, at some point I realized, wow, I actually think I really want to do this, but I didn't really know the people or anything. And I'm, yeah, thankful for the people in our lives who I guess come to our aid when we're looking for guidance. So thank you for sharing so much about that. And you gave this really concise description of how your career trajectory sort of paralleled the development of some of the things that we're going to talk about today, which is treatment for substance use disorder, neuroscience, and maybe how these fields are starting to interact, and obviously have been in some capacity in the past, but will probably do more so as we move forward. And so we're really excited to hear from a foremost expert in this today, and wondering if we could kind of just start a little bit of, you know, maybe this is a tall order, so but a brief sort of overview of substance use disorder treatment as it stands, psychosocial treatments. You know, what are some of the what are some of the approaches, the pros, the cons, the limitations, whatnot? Tall order question. You've got 5 minutes. Yeah, from your
when
vantage
I
point.
think of substance use disorder treatment, I think broadly CBT relapse prevention, right? That's what is the kind of been the driving force up to this point, and a lot of the treatments that are have been tested stem from that model. And at Brown, learning the functional analysis, you run through it. What's the trigger, thought, feeling, behavior, consequence, and then from there, identifying where some vulnerabilities might be for the individual, and that's where some of these other treatment modalities have been developed, such as we do behavioral activation or mindfulness-based relapse prevention, for example. And so, just big picture, I would say CBT relapse prevention is where the evidence is, and where mo what most evidence-based treatment programs are providing. And when I talk about treatment, I think it's helpful to provide some context that my work has been initially with illicit drug use, and also that also includes alcohol and nicotine use, but very rarely in settings where it's just alcohol use disorder. So most of my frame of reference is for Sure. Individuals that go that have a illicit substance use disorder and are going to a community-based treatment program, outpatient, intensive outpatient, maybe short-term residential detox or long-term residential. And in these treatment programs, so I'm saying CBT relapse prevention, but broadly speaking is what we know it works. That isn't always what's provided.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Frontline treatment centers, I think, some of them have some of this stuff worked in, and maybe there's a motivational interviewing like sprinkle that happens on top.
Of course. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But typically, you know, I come from a background working in frontline addiction treatment before I even went to undergrad, and there it was like mutual help group focused. It was a lot of kind of like idiosyncratic treatment approaches that were developed in the context of the treatment center that's hosting said treatment, right? So it's kind of like a blend of various factors. And then whatever the state agency basically is requesting, that agency slowly start to pivot to. But rarely is that like a full-blown CBT relapse prevention model.
No, and they're in these very large groups.
Yes.
The treatment's being provided, so that's not individualized in any way.
No, that's a great
point.
And
the treatment providers that are there, they're working very hard. They're wonderful people, but they don't have the training always needed to deliver those evidence-based approaches.
Yeah. And licensure in addiction treatment more broadly, right, has kind of some lower barriers from an education perspective to get into the field, which is great. We need more practitioners, but the cost of that is what you're talking about here, which is that the depth of training in a thing like CBT, maybe they talked about it for a week or two in a class, right? And then largely they plug in play into a treatment center and do what the treatment center does, which is not individualized to the folks necessarily that are occupying the large groups that are there, and instead, you know, making some tweaks in an individual therapy session that happens. Maybe they get four of those over the course of a month, right? And so pros and cons.
So you know, obviously there's this as we just discussed, there's this huge variability almost in what is being provided in these different places. Has a stronger evidence based than others, and among those that do have this stronger evidence based, do you think that you could give us a little bit of an overview? Obviously there's some variability across treatments, but in general, what are the success rates? What would we expect? And are there, I know a lot of your work is sort of based on trying to close the gap and have these treatments help even more. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, even these treatments that we are testing and are, we're developing and testing. So everyone is trained, graduate students or Dr. Love, you know, are trained to deliver these evidence-based treatments. Even then the rate of return to substance use is very high. You know, it depends on the study you look at. It could be anywhere from, you know, 30 to 70% within the next year. And so there's a huge proportion of individuals where that these treatments, the best treatments out there delivered by people who are well-trained, are still not working.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, that, you know, at best, when you look at the global perspective across all modalities that have evidence, right, we see modestly effective treatments at best, right? And it kind of sounds like that was part of your journey, was to, when you're plugging into some of the places in DC and saying like, what's going on here? What are the factors associated with people who are like successful versus maybe people who are going to return to use, in short order after treatment, right? Within the first year, which is kind of the gold standard for sustained remission, which it, right. And so maybe you could talk to us a little bit about some of the factors that you started to kind of really think about in that space and how that kind of took you on this journey.
Right. Well, starting out with distress tolerance, that was the mechanism of interest there. And the way that took me on the journey, well, I guess it's getting away from it. We did do some treatment development work there. But for me, the distress tolerance work was much more mechanistic. And then looking using fMRI to probe about what is really going on with distress tolerance, right? So if someone has low distress tolerance, what does that mean about how we should treat them? Now, we know that there are distress tolerance interventions in the context of DBT, but still I'm not sure we had a full understanding of like what's going on there. Is this a cognitive deficit where under stress someone has a harder time in, you know, with inhibitory control, right, in that state? Or is it just the stress itself that is the problem and needing to reduce the stress? So I think that's it was unclear what distress tolerance was made up of. And that's why, you know, I turned to neuroscience to see if I could get a better picture of that, right? So in the brain, is it prefrontal cortex or is it, you know, default mode salience network, or is it some communication among those networks? And by knowing that, can we then develop a treatment that might help better address the vulnerability? But then also some of the other things is reward processing, right? Individuals who may be depressed, but even if they're not depressed, they're not motivated for substance-free rewards, environmental rewards like they used to. And that's where behavioral activation was a very obvious tool to try to address that. But then you have individuals in substitute treatment who really do enjoy still their environmental reward. And they're very motivated to do other things other than engage in substance use. But every time they have to come to make a decision, they choose to engage in the substance use, right? That habit-based responding, goal-directed behavior, you know, what is getting in the way there? Where maybe behavioral activation isn't necessarily the answer, but something more with habit formation, goal-directed behavior, executive control. And so my goal has been to really probe these mechanisms and see, you know, what can we find out about them and better treat them. And then it also gets back to assessment too. Once we know that, how can we make sure that someone comes into treatment and there gets a very clear assessment of what's going on with this individual, and what is going to work best versus everyone kind of getting the same big group relapse prevention treatment that isn't really addressing what they need.
That's a great point. Yeah, I think assessment gets very little love in this space, right? People think like, tell me how much you're using.
Yeah.
Right. Like
right.
Right. And we basically know, right, that like how much you use accounts for less than 20% of the variance in problems that you're experiencing. Right. And so it has to be some other factors that are going on here at play, right? Whether it's a person's ability to tolerate stress, which, you know, if listeners are unfamiliar, early recovery is stressful. Early recovery is stressful. You're making a lot of changes to your life. There's a lot of pressure points from external factors, whether that's legal, family, right? You're making changes. Residential substance use treatment is not particularly accessible, right? Like you have to put your whole life on hold.
Stress goes up, reward goes down.
Yes, right. All the stuff that you enjoy goes down, and all the stuff that you don't enjoy goes up. It makes it very challenging.
And what you were doing to cope with all of the stress that you already
had. They're like, don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Your very reliable and immediate solution. Shout out, right? Brown ADP. All right. For the functional analysis. Right. Right. We all did it.
Did you do ADP too, Stacey?
Yep.
Of course
me
did.
Too.
Yeah. We all did. Yeah. The impact, the footprint of that on the field is just, as a quick aside, huge. Right. Yeah. But like, right, it has a very immediate and reliable impact on a person's life. And then we're like, don't do that, yo. Try something else, but you don't know how to do that. Well,
and we're not really helping them figure out how to do that or giving
that's
them
the
space.
Thing.
And then with the, I think critically is the lack of a harm reduction approach that has really hampered things. And,
yes.
You know, telling someone you can't and then punishing them when they make a mistake versus saying, okay, well, this is going to be hard. So maybe for the first, you know, for this week, your goal is just to do it four times instead of six times, right? And that's definitely not integrated into treatment.
Yeah,
no. Luckily, I think that's, you know, some of the landscape on that is slowly starting to shift.
Yep.
But the ghost of the war on drugs and abstinence-only recovery, really, right? Like, unlike, and maybe I soapbox this too often, but I'm going to do it again here, right? Like, if you were depressed and you got sad, nobody's like, go to jail, right? Like, that doesn't happen. But in substance use disorder, it does. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know how many talks I've had in frontline addiction treatment where people are like, oh, they used, we should kick them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, wait a sec. What if they were sad? We wouldn't be like, you're out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
no
that
more
is
treatment
the policy.
For you.
They do urine testing. And if they.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
So all of that is all bound up in, you know, things like the war on drugs and abstinence only recovery and things like that. And, you know, luckily those things are shifting. But, you know, as we think about it, right, like trying to match these skills to a specific person's set of goals that's more consistent with what's feasible,
yeah,
given what we know what their life is going to be like, is like the way we have to do this.
Yeah.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why I think some of the work that you've done here is, really important, in that it's really trying to kind of figure out how we can connect the dots between a person's experience and what's going to be most helpful.
Well, and you are sort of, I think, moving, I'll say it this way, I guess, you outlined 5 to 7 hypotheses of why someone might be struggling in any given moment. And we know that what's most likely true is that some of those are true for some people at some times, right? And so it's sort of a movement towards precision medicine a little bit. And, to right now, to not, our treatment centers often do not adequately assess these things. They do not give allowance for people to return to use and then sort of restart or get back on the path. And then to not have treatments that target these things either, we're really doing a lot of disservices. So that's how I see your work really in many ways informing all of these areas and trying to improve all of that. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you did find with those studies, those early studies, and connecting some of the mechanisms to neuroscience.
Yeah, so for the distress tolerance work, we did find that their low distress tolerance, or the inability to persist in goal-directed behavior when experiencing distress, is related to reduced, or should I say lower, neural response to stress during a stress tolerance task in the prefrontal cortex. And then when looking at the connectivity there's greater or reduced connectivity between, or increased connectivity, sorry, between the default mode network and the salience network. So there's a lot of stress processing happening, and that's related to lower distress tolerance. And within network connectivity of the executive control network. So basically what we had hypothesized. And then we did some work with reward processing as well. We developed, so the monitoring center delay task is often used when looking at neural correlates of reward processing. But we were, we're not necessarily interested in whether individuals are responsive to money cues, right? Because money cues can mean many different things. It could be a cue for substances. And so we developed a monitoring center delay test for activity, pleasant activity images. And so we, replaced, really in line with BA, when you see people doing things that are fun and engaging, right? Mm. What happens to your neural response? And so we tested that within opiate use disorder, and found that that individuals who with opiate use disorder had increased reward response to after seeing the images, but anticipation of the images, they had a reduced reward response. That really goes into, really supported the theory that yes, there is a reduced motivation for engagement or for non-substance rewards. So those are two studies that stick out where we did kind of really look at, pick these phenotypes and then really look at what might be going on neurally.
Yeah. And that stuff seems to be, somewhat consistent with, maybe like allostasis models of addiction, which suggests that, due to overactivation of the reward centers over time, that things that are not drug related become increasingly less rewarding. And given how potent drug reward is, and your brain was like, yo, that's problematic, because like food and tacos and all this other stuff are like super important for life. And so they offset it with stress hormones, which make your emotions bigger, especially when you're not using. Right. And so it makes sense that people are experiencing lots of stress and poor management of the stress, and spending a lot of time processing things related to the stress, and less opportunity, less processing of alternative rewards, right?
Right.
And that really kind of propels a person maybe potentially back to use, is what it sounds like.
Right. Right. That's the idea. We want to, in treatment, rebalance the focus and time spent on substance use versus non-substance use. And so what's getting in the way is it the reward processing, the degree to which someone enjoys or looks forward to those non-substance use reinforcers.
Yeah, no, you mentioned tacos. No, those are the essential things in life
that
we need to get back to, right?
Tacos.
Yeah. I should have had chocolate. Actually in our task, we should have had tacos. And we probably should have done that.
Tacos, chocolate, right? There's a couple of key things like that. It was probably like pictures of a park or something like that, right?
I think that's another one that that's obviously really important. Stacy, we've talked about this because I'm really interested in the substance-free rewards stuff as well, but this finding that you have where, you know, maybe the actual response is relatively the same, but that anticipatory that seems really important, because that is kind of what happens. It's like when you're thinking about the choice, and the salience of these options are presented to you, just sort of that lack of salience is maybe something that would keep someone from making another choice in that moment.
Yeah,
that's a really good point right there, right? Yeah. It's not that, like, Sam. A lot of times, right, when we work with people in a behavior activation context, once we get them to do it, they're like, oh, that was actually really enjoyable, right? But it's like, there's like all these extra barriers that appear to be anchored in potentially kind of neural response patterns that have adapted over time due to chronic substance use that interfere with their ability to say, like, you know what, that probably is going to work. Right. I'm like, oh, I want you to go have tacos. And they're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Right. All that anticipatory kind of motivation that propels a person towards the activity seems to be diminished. And I work with teens a lot. And when I work with teens, I'm like, yo, let's try this. And they're like, not going to work, dude. And they're like, I don't know, man. Why don't you try it? And they're like, oh, you know, all this stuff came up. And, you know, and I saw my friends and poof, it was over. Right. And I think we got to appreciate that more. It's not like a person isn't interested in change, right? It's that the factors that would normally drive a person towards change are getting interrupted in this process.
Yes.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it like that. I mean, I do think about it sometimes as like, they don't necessarily have the raw materials necessary to like generate the type of reward necessary, but it actually appears to be some stuff in the middle too, right?
Yeah,
the anticipatory, which is very potent for substance use.
Right. And I think that's it. And what we've found seen clinically is there is a lot more motivation than, you know, going into this initially, I was like, oh, it's depression and SED. And our findings have actually shown that in the first couple of studies we did we tested behavioral activation for people with both SED and major depression. And then in the study that we published in 2018, we did not exclude, I mean, we included people who did not have major depressive disorder. And what we found was that, in that population, even within depression, there is a motivation and a desire to engage in other activities. Mm-hmm. It is, I mean, sitting there thinking about it, I want to do, yes, I can do this, you know, much more so than what we would have thought. We thought we'd have a very difficult time coming up with things that they wanted to do. They wouldn't want to do anything, like imagine an anhedonic state, but that wasn't the case. And so, but then it is that what gets in the way. It's the, you know, oh, I'll plan it, and then they forget and don't want to. Then they lose interest quickly, and then the salience of what they normally are used to doing, their habit, becomes much greater, and that's what they're pulled towards instead.
Yeah.
It gets a little bit into this goal-directed behavior for delayed reward, right?
It's like almost like anything that kind of pops up as a barrier, even small, you know, there's just – that might be enough to interrupt this sort of progression that it takes to get to these delayed rewards.
Mm-hmm. And some of the work does look at within the mid task is the timing too. And there's some evidence that the sustained reward response is depleted in substance use disorder. So there can be this initial excitement, but throughout the task, that excitement, you know, that response starts to get depleted. So there's some potential, there's not enough evidence yet, but there is some there that it is the sustained reward responses is not there.
Yeah, which stands in stark contrast to specific drugs like stimulants or things like this, which have very long lasting reward, right? And it, kind of always, it also circles back, I think, in part to, you know, if we go keep going back to ADP, but for those who don't know, which is the partial hospitalization program at Butler Hospital as part of Brown's internship that for some reason everybody on the show always does. But it's also like these things are variable and hard to learn. You don't know how to do that thing, but you're like super great at using drugs. Right. Yes. Like I am the man at using drugs. Right.
And
like,
it feels good.
Yeah.
And
I know exactly what to do. And
reliable.
Right. It's reliable. Yeah. It's immediate. And like, you know, maybe something like exercise that like the timing of the reward is not synced up with how you're hoping it's going to work. And also there's all these other barriers like, oh, I got to like get there and I got to like do all these things. And if all the anticipatory reward isn't as potent, like navigating through those barriers is more challenging. And then once I get there, maybe I get a little bump, but then it goes down after time. Then they want to go back again and things like that are just kind of diminished over time. Yeah. It just creates this, you know, kind of self-perpetuating system that pushes you back towards the thing that's super reliable and immediate and that I know how to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's, there isn't as much, you know, acknowledgement as needs to be on the fact that the reward outcome of reducing substance use is not always great, and it's unknown, right?
Yeah,
like,
it's
what
variable.
Is life? What is life really going to look like without my substance use?
And that, an early phase is really stressful, right? And so, it like, kind of also kind of like, are you sure?
And also, though, in settings where you know people have had a difficult time and they're low income, and their options are not great. Yes, in theory, exercise is going to be great for me, but I don't actually know what that looks like. I can't imagine it. Like, what kind of positive outcome is going to come from that? I guess I'll be healthy. I'm supposed to want to be healthy, but does that feel good? I'm not really sure. I don't know.
Yeah. And a lot of those things aren't very accessible, right? We had Matt Field on the show and we talked about this, and Kyle Walters talked a little bit about it on his episode too, right? We're like, many people live in kind of reinforcement deserts.
Yep.
Right. That like their communities don't have access to the things that we're saying like are going to work all the time. And there's
and
even
so
all these barriers
thing,
like that.
Yeah. And one thing that I, you know, one thing I like about behavioral activation and that I think is important and different from, you know, just like event scheduling is that in these resource depleted environments, finding the things that individuals value and then doing things in line with those values. And they can be very small and not big, pleasant events, you know, in the environment.
Yeah, I do think, you know, because so many of these delayed rewards, the value actually, like working out, some people, the first time they work out, they might feel pleasure, but really probably what they're going to feel is pain, right?
Yes, yes. I can confirm that is correct.
Right. And even while you're doing it, if you do it regularly, you might often feel some amount of pain throughout. And the benefit actually comes in this really sort of diffuse way throughout your days and weeks and months where you're exercising regularly and you just feel better. And when you're asking someone to look at these sort of discrete activities and comparing them with something like substance use, which is immediate and potent, and you're going to feel good, and then exercise, which is there's going to be some sort of like indescribable abstract feeling overall, you know, if you do this regularly. Right, exactly. It's really hard. And so behavioral activation, tying it to that value can be really, really helpful in just say, you know, this is moving you towards that person that you want to be, and also sort of structuring reinforcement so that even though you might not be getting that all of that boost from this sort of reward bundle, you are getting a little bit as you go. I really like all that. Well, and you know, we went on a little bit of a tangent that I thought was really helpful, but I do want to, you know, We have all of these treatments, these psychosocial treatments that in some way or another try to call attention to these processes, or, you know, some do them better than others, or are more explicit or implicit about it than others. But functional analysis might bring awareness to all of these factors, all the barriers in any given moment that keep an individual from being able to, you know, make one decision or another. Behavioral activation sort of structures and helps them understand what's available to them and then sets out a plan to do that. Now, some of what I understand you're doing now is taking the marriage of these different areas of research that you've started, and you're actually maybe thinking of ways to along with other people in the field as well, to start to build on top of these psychosocial treatments? How can you create an adjunct or an add-on to these psychosocial treatments that targets the neural mechanism and actually enhances the efficacy? So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. So the idea here is very much in line with the tangent we just got on, which is what gets in the way, right? There's so many things that get in the way and it doesn't happen overnight. And especially in the early stages of treatment, you may be starting a mindfulness-based relapse prevention or behavioral activation focus, or your whatever it is you're focusing on with the individual, it's very hard for them to engage and to learn the skills and practice the skills with a lot of the other stuff that's going on, and in particular, some executive control deficits, right? So inhibitory control, delayed discounting, all of that is making it harder for the individual, despite how motivated they might be, to engage and get stuff out of treatment. And so after I got to UNC, so I'd already done some of the neural work, and I was like, okay, well, what do I do with this, right? Like, how do you, I know we could obviously tailor psychosocial interventions to what we see neurally, but also can we intervene neurally? And I started collaborating with Flavio Frolic here at UNC, and he does brain stimulation work, particularly transcranial alternating stimulant, transcranial alternate stimulation. And so what we ran a study looking at the effect of TACS on inhibitory control and distress tolerance, and we found that it did improve inhibitory control. And so that's where that started. And the idea being now is what, I'd like to do next. We're collecting some more data, looking at oscillation frequencies related to these constructs. We want to make sure we get the brain stimulation targets correct, but so more of that mechanistic work. But can we combine, the brain stimulation with the psychosocial treatment, and does that help the individual to engage in the treatment and better outcomes because of that?
What'd you find? Is that on the future, or is that something you already got cooked?
Oh, no, we have not done that yet.
I'd be very interested.
I think that's going to be really impactful because, it's kind of like the way I guess I personally think about medications. I know other people.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
Think it's more primary, but it's just like, if you can just give them that little boost to help in those moments.
I think it's very, very similar. And so I think, Tim, that's a perfect example. So we have, sometimes combined medication and behavioral treatment is more effective than one alone, with the idea that you eventually wean the individual off of the medication so that they're not reliant on it. And here, that's the idea. Can we provide the brain stimulation? Will it provide that boost that is needed to help the individual? One thing we found with medications is that the targets are not accurate, right? Like serotonin, like SSRIs, et cetera. And so with the brain stimulation, one reason, like we haven't actually run the treatment and brainstem combo study yet, is because we were realizing that we might not have the oscillation patterns, correct, because we haven't pinpointed per phenotype what are the oscillation patterns in the brain associated with each phenotype. So we're taking a step back and really we're running. Right now I'm collaborating also with Christian Hendershot. He's here at UNC now, and we're looking at the EEG correlates of goal-directed behavior and smoking behavior. And so really and delay discounting, and if we can identify those and how they're related to an individual's ability to delay smoking in a smoking chamber, then we know exactly which frequencies to use for the brain stimulation so that we get it right. And it's not we're not doing the same thing that we do in psychosocial treatment where we give everyone the same brain, the same stimulation pattern. Well, it's probably different. There are different needs based on different phenotype vulnerabilities.
Wow. Well, and in this sort of futuristic movie that's playing in my head, I can see giving someone an assessment, understanding what areas they're struggling in, and then having these specific things targeting Rather than doing, the same thing for each, but if you understand the neural, the phenotype and all of the neural markers, and you understand, and then you can target that sort of psychosocial side, the neural side, the medication side. A future like that, I mean, seems like we would have pretty good results.
Well, we hope so.
That I think that's a good point, right? I think one of the ways I always like to think about it, right, is that like a person's, we exist as a complicated system that has biology that anchors it in part, right? And a lot of times, early recovery, your biology is pulling against what you're trying to change. And, medications have historically been like the one way we're like, oh, we're going to like leverage biology in a way to help you overcome these anchors that are keeping you stuck when you're trying to move your behavior. Right. And medications are diffuse and non-targeted and take a long ass time to work, right? Like SSRIs take like 6 weeks. And it's like most people, when we look at the treatment data, return to use faster than that, much faster than that. Right. When we taught, relapse prevention, for instance, at ADP to call it back, right? Like we talk about statistics about where people end up kind of returning back, and it happens early on. And so the idea that we're going to wait 6 weeks before it's going to kick in, and it's also not going to be like very obvious. It's going to creep in real slow, like, and all of a sudden you're just going to notice it's not that way anymore, right? Like historically, that hasn't really been effective, which is, some of the work
No.
that like we've done, Sam and I, with Bob Miranda, talking about like maybe medications that are happening faster, right? Or medications that can happen earlier in the process that actually reinforce the actual mechanism of change that we're thinking about from behavior perspective, not just like, oh, we're going to give you an SSRI and that'll probably make you feel better, and then we're going to do drug refusal skills. And it's like those things are not really connected, right? But doing something that actually boosts cognitive functioning as you're learning a task that allows that task to be kind of solidified and applied much quicker in the early stage of recovery when risk is the highest sounds like the move, right? And medications, side note, people who don't know, medications got side effects all the time, and most people absolutely hate them. And also a bunch of, recovery communities have specific negative views on medications as not being truly in recovery. NA, for instance, has strong opinions on things like replacement therapies and so forth. And so maybe something like this can overcome the downsides of non-targeted biological support systems for early recovery, due to its non-invasive approach, right? You're talking about like putting somebody in a chair and kind of putting a magnet near their head for a little bit.
So there's, the TMS, which is magnetic stimulation, and then there's the electrostimulation, which is TDCS or TACS is what we've been using. And one thing that, the field has a long way to go for brain stimulation. The majority of studies have really been on the acute effects on craving. And some studies on consumption that have been inconsistent and have not been long-term follow-up. So we really don't know the effectiveness of brain stimulation on these phenotypes in the context of substance use disorder over time. And so we have so much work to do, but theoretically it should work, right? And that's why we're spending time on this to try to figure out if it does. And just also, I think one of the advantages to know about, so TMS is effective. It's more of a deep brain stimulation, but it is expensive, and you have to come in for multiple. Most of the studies have like 20 to 30 sessions, and it's not it's less feasible than electric stimulation, where most of the studies have fewer sessions involved, and it's more portable and cheaper. So I mean, all the work is critical because it helps us to understand what works and why. So eventually, this is something that can be distributed or disseminated to within treatment centers or et cetera. Right now it's not at that point.
Yeah, that makes
Yeah, well,
sense.
in so many times it's just something that you said earlier about like TMS or some of these non-invasive procedures. Maybe we're unsure about the efficacy. It's a little uncertain, especially when it comes to consumption outcomes. One thing I think we haven't done as well in our field is to look at sort of the combined effects of things, because I think sometimes we think, oh, well, that didn't work, and so therefore it's not effective. But I think oftentimes it's sort of a necessary but not sufficient situation where, well, actually, if we put this with something else that targets another mechanism, maybe we're going to see like this massive effect where we'll see almost nothing without having targeted both. So I'm really excited just to see where it all goes. And I hope that we stick with some of these different strategies long enough. And this is the importance of pursuing random lines of scientific inquiry, because like, sometimes it takes decades before you finally, you know, realize, oh, okay, actually this is taking us somewhere. So, I mean, I have faith that it'll be useful, but, you know, even, you know, I hope we all, I hope you persist if there are some initial failures.
We'll see what my distress tolerance level
is.
There
you go.
Right. There
you go.
Like...
to bring it full circle. Right. And just to be fair for anybody out there listening, right, I think studies like the ones you're doing and many that we've talked about over the course of our conversation here, that like not finding things are equally as important as finding things.
Yeah.
Right. Like finding out that like it, let's pretend there's a future where like none of this works out. Like that was worth it. Like next, right? Or like maybe there's something in there.
And that's right? The beauty actually of, I think, open science. I mean, the pre-registration now is that all of those non-findings are going to get out there so that we know ahead of time and we're not all pursuing these things in parallel and having no success and no one knows about it, right? So
that's a great point. Yeah, I do think I'm obviously biased, but I think null findings have a real strong place, if not strongest place.
Absolutely.
Proving something in science is very hard, but finding reliably not effects, I think, is a much easier approach. And like, if we could just like start scratching stuff off the list, that would be really important.
Yeah.
But we instead have this like circular pattern where like, what's old is new again, right? Like, and people are like, oh, we've buried that under a mountain of studies, and now something they did in the 50s is back in vogue, but maybe we're doing it different, and that's important too, right? But like,
or we're calling it something different. Yes.
The jingle jangle fallacy. Yes. Psychology is a real problem. For those who don't know, we're the best at it in psychology, which is we have two words that mean the same thing. And then we have one word that means two things. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge problem in our field. And it's one of your favorite, I think it's one of your favorite things to bring up, Noah. I feel like almost every episode we talk about jingle jangle.
It's the worst.
But it's super worst. Important. Right. Yeah. I mean,
the worst,
it's like,
I talk to my students all the time. I'm like, oh, could you find something for this? And they're like, I couldn't find anything. And I was like, oh, what about this? And they're like, how did you find that? And I'm like, oh, I knew there was another word for it.
There's another word for it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That comes with experience, right? But it's like, it's problematic.
I think we could have a generation of scientists who just pare it all down, you know, to like combine measures, put it into a single measure.
Yeah.
Theories.
Please, someone out there.
Weed them out. Like, that would be like maybe one of the most significant things someone could do in our field, you know, is just to get us all on the same page about things.
Yeah, agreed.
So just briefly, Stacey, I know we're sort of coming towards the end and we want to ask you our take homes and advice for other people. But I'm wondering, you talked about the non-invasive. Do you know anything about the more invasive deep brain stimulation? You know, not going into detail, but is there work being done with that for substance use? And, you know, has it shown any, this is my off the wall question, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's not off the wall at all. And there is some work, but because it's invasive in nature, it's hard to have controlled studies.
Yeah.
And also because to do it it's intensive. And so the feasibility of that is limited as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's the juice worth the squeeze, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Wow, I like that. I've never heard that phrase.
It's one of my new favorites. I find a lot of things are not. A lot of things the juice ain't worth the squeeze.
Maybe
that's just me.
Noah, you said recently a camel is a horse designed by a committee. And
that's correct.
I've thought about that a couple times a week for a long time. So
they wanted to build a beautiful horse and said that they came with his camel. That's what happens all the time.
And I love
usually
that.
Those committees are not, the juice is not worth the squeeze.
That's right. No. That's right.
Those two parts of
the
same
camel,
experience.
Right. Because the camel's now useless, right?
Yeah. It's not, it doesn't run fast. Like it doesn't, right. All the stuff that you want a horse to do, a camel doesn't do other than you can ride it. Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there's a
So
couple of
funny.
those that, and honestly, those two phrases are like connected
So
in
what
my
I would love
mind.
to know is what
Yeah.
juice is worth the squeeze? Yes.
Quality question. That's an empirical question that we'll have to find out. But I'll here to tell you, it's not committees.
Yeah.
Because
No.
that's what I'm talking about is like these committees at institutions where we get there and we just get like a lot of people, smart people thinking about all the angles. And then by the end, we have this camel and we didn't get anything done it's other than an hour of time has gone by.
Yeah, sometimes
No.
in academia we have
Groupthink.
the almost opposite problem of substance use, which is we are so obsessed with delayed reward that we don't
Yes.
have any
You
immediate.
could put this in there. That might help. Lunch, add this, add that. Don't forget.
Yeah, don't
Right.
forget. Also, what about this angle, right? And
Yeah.
then the last phrase that we'll use to tie this committee thing in a knot is right that the perfection is the enemy of progress, and
Yes.
that's true
Yes.
across the board in substance use disorder treatment. It's like, well, we can't make any progress because it's not perfect, and it's like, well, nothing's going to be perfect
No.
because people are really unique,
Sure.
and their lives are very unique, and they're the experts in themselves, and I can never understand it like they do. And so progress is really the key here. Can we
Yeah. Right.
reduce your
Yeah.
risk profile? Can we reduce the number of use days or use events consistent with how you want your life to be, right? Can we help you improve your distress tolerance? And that's going to have all other effects. Check it out. I have distress across my life in multiple places, not just in early recovery, right? That my family is stressful, my job is stressful, and has cross-cutting effects on it. And so I really think that your work here helps us to kind of tackle those things and understand that like we're really just trying to make progress in this space, and that very few things are going to be perfect. In fact, perfection is probably just unachievable, and we should just put that to the side as a goal and try to figure out how we can make progress with this one person or this one kind of group of people who have similar processes that unify them, and parts of their experience that make them unique.
Yeah, and I
Yeah.
think it's very well said. And I think part of what that makes me think of is the importance of goal assessment and what we
Yeah.
are deciding is the goal, right? And it's not the same goal that everyone coming into treatment has. Their goal isn't
Yes.
necessarily to completely stop their use or, and that tends to be our outcome of interest, right?
Yes.
Or reductions of use, what we think is a meaningful reduction of use compared to what they think is a meaningful reduction of use. Because if we are supportive of whatever goal they come up with, it's actually likely to enable to motivate them to continue to make positive change in some direction.
Yeah.
But when it comes to research studies, it makes it very complicated. You know, how do
That's
you
a great
test
point.
the effectiveness of something when the outcome is a lot of times not aligned with what the individual wants the outcome to be.
Yeah, that's a great point. The substance use disorder industrial complex does not tolerate that well. The regulatory bodies that fund studies don't tolerate that well. Nor do approval agencies like FDA and other places like that
Yeah.
kind of put things onto the market.
Starting to change with, some of the changing definitions of recovery and
Great
allowing
point. Yeah, I was going to
for
bring that up.
drinking in moderation, for
Yeah, or quality of
example.
life changes, right? To
quality of
quality of
life, right?
life.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, more evidence for the impact of quality of life on other things
Yes.
to help get some, maybe some policy changes in that. Yeah.
Yeah,
Agreed.
absolutely.
Agreed.
Well, Stacey, this has been just really enlightening, and I really appreciate you spending some of your really valuable time with us. And I think this will be really informative for our listeners. I'm wondering if we could shift towards our take-home messages.
Okay.
So typically, what these are, we have four questions, and sort of geared towards specific stakeholder groups, and just a 30-second to a minute summary of how what we discussed today might have affect these groups. So, the first one, what do you think the take-home message or messages would be from your work for people in recovery?
Well, I think if we want to just focus narrowly, what we have found clinically is when we talk to people in treatment that about the effects of substance use on the brain and how that actually can that impacts how they're feeling at this very moment and how it impacts the why it's hard right now, and that actually with a reduction in substance use that your brain will recover, right? That has is very enlightening for people to hear, and it provides hope. So getting some more psychoeducation out there for people in recovery about the neural impact of the use that they've engaged in and how it can get better.
Yeah,
That's a
totally. really great point. What would you say the take-home message is for practitioners out there?
It's a tough one. I think it's more systemic is my message. I think for individual practitioners are doing the best that they can. A lot of them are forced to see clients in big groups, but the degree to which they can identify individual needs and make it more from a precision medicine approach. Like what is this individual having the most difficulty with, and looking into the science of how you treat that vulnerability.
Yeah. Great point. Yeah. Absolutely. What do you feel like the take-home message would be for policymakers?
Funding for training.
Yeah.
For practitioners.
I think.
Put the money out there. That's the only way you're going to see a difference, right?
Yeah.
The science is there, but incorporating the scientific findings into also the policy of what treatments need to be provided. It's not a one size fit all, and being more updating guidelines more quickly as the science comes out, and demanding that the practitioners receive that training in order to get reimbursed.
Yeah. Those are really large effects that can happen at a large scale. And so I really appreciate that point. What would you say the take-home message is for underserved populations?
I feel like substance use is most of the individuals that we see, they're all an underserved population. So the message for people in recovery who are underserved is to know that there are there is science out there supporting effective approaches, and to ask questions about what treatment you're getting and why, and also to know that it's a process, and that there is no failure. It's as long as you're slowly making improvements that you feel good about, you're on the right path.
Yeah. Thank you, Stacy. So we have one more question for you. And a question we ask all of our guests, but I'm excited to hear your answer. So you've been really, really successful in your career. You've made the pivots that we discussed earlier, and you're doing some very impactful research. And I'm wondering just if you have any advice for trainees, for early career folk out there.
Shoot, that's so much. Sorry,
you can give multiple pieces of advice.
I'm sorry, I didn't prepare this one. Let me.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, we can cut all this part out in the middle.
Yeah, we will.
Oh yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, and also the part
you're just assuming that one.
I'm just assuming it. Yeah,
that's true. And also the part at the end of Sam's question, right? Obviously, we're gonna cut that.
Weird thing that I did. Yeah,
yeah,
whatever that was.
I would say enjoy the process. Mm-hmm. That. A lot of times we get focused on the outcomes and meeting certain milestones and having success. And I'm not going to lie, you do need to do those things if you want to continue in a field of research. It's tough out there. But I would say the thing that's kept me going is really enjoying what the question is and the intellectual curiosity and the process of engaging in research. And then you'll always be able to, I think we talked about this earlier, you can pivot all the time, and that's the beauty of what we do. And so just continuing to really focus on the process, the research process, more than the outcomes and what's important to you and interesting and important to the field.
Yeah. I love that, Stacey. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Agreed. Well, thank you so much for your time to give some of your knowledge and expertise to our listeners and for taking a little bit of time out of your busy schedule to chat with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.